Accession number 27344, reel 6.
Robert McCandless, reel 6. I'd just like to ask you, if I could, about the ground instruction that you were receiving at that time.
Yeah, well, it was just an advanced version of what we were doing during the elementary flying training, including weapons, the Sten gun. That was about as far as it went, although we did look at a Lewis gun, but none of our aircraft were ever going to have Lewis guns. So it was the sort of weapons that you might find in a current fleet air arm aircraft. And the 303 machine gun was about the size of it. So that was the weapons. And then we still carried on with the signalling, because the Navy was of the opinion that we in the air ought to be able to understand ship signals as well as air signals. And to a certain extent, I can understand why they did do that, because sometimes when you were operational, you were flying around a fleet, and it was nice to know what the fleet was going to do, and you would know what it was going to do if you watched the signals on the flagship, and to watch the signals and read them and understand that the next signal meant we're going to turn 90 degrees to starboard or whatever it was useful. So I agree with the Admiralty view that we ought to be able to read naval signals as well as to do Morse. They didn't insist on semaphore, but they used to teach us semaphore just in case it might come in handy sometime. Not that it ever did.
The naval signals, is that the flag system?
Yes.
That's operated by the Navy?
That's right. And we just used to learn the more regularly used ones. I mean, not England expects sort of thing, but what the action were for the fleet. Then, in addition to signals, we would do aircraft recognition, and that was something which was always being updated. I don't know if I told you that we used to work down to shutter speeds for seeing the aircraft on the screen, and sometimes with a shutter speed of whatever it was, you know, like a photograph, you would just have a tail, a fin, showing on the screen, and you had to say which aircraft that fin belonged to. And the reason that they gave for this was that sometimes when you're flying around, particularly in cloudy conditions, you might just have a flash of an aircraft going across a gap in clouds, and you want to know whether it's friendly or enemy. So they did insist on us getting down to this photographic speed of recognition. And we'd also do ship recognition. Now, this was very important, as you probably remember, from the time of the Bismarck, when the Sheffield was attacked accidentally. And that was attacked simply because somebody didn't recognise it. I know the weather was terrible, but the ship recognition should have been good enough to know that that wasn't the Bismarck. So we used to do ship recognition quite a lot, and we got to know the... I'm sorry, this cough must be terrible. We got to know the British fleet well, the American fleet quite well, the German fleet quite well, and the Russian fleet quite well. But then, of course, the Italians and the French had their ships in, and... it was a mass of ships, and even going down to fairly small ones that we had to recognise. So again, it was practice, practice, practice. Navigation. We used to do that on the ground, navigation exercises, so that we could do it in the air. Now, in the air, for navigation, we used to have a map, probably with lines already drawn on it, because you knew where you were supposed to be going, and a little sort of circular slide rule strapped to your leg. And this was called a Dalton computer. And on it you could do navigation, but you had to practice using it. So we used to do navigation exercises on the ground using a Dalton computer that we would have in the air. And it's amazing how skillful you could become and how fast you could get the answer to the next question. As I said to you, if you find yourself off course, you've got to calculate a new course to get back to your target. And it was the Dalton computer that helped you to do that. So it was just a matter of getting used to using it. So navigation was quite regular. What else? Dear, oh dear, I do forget.
Well, one of the things we mentioned earlier was the parachute. You mentioned parachute.
Yes.
Did you do parachute training anywhere else?
Yeah, well, we used to do quite a lot of physical training of all kinds to keep us fit. And there was a safety equipment officer there who would teach us how to use parachute and dinghies. Part of the parachute pack was an inflatable dinghy. So we had to learn how to use those. But for parachute jumping, it really was a matter of jumping off a platform and swinging down in the normal parachute harness. And they used to say it was like jumping from 16 feet of parachute landing. And you would just swing down, thump into the mats, and learn to roll over to get out of it. Of course, that's fine, but it doesn't work when you're landing in water. You can't roll over. So, landing in water, the drill is that as you're coming down, you look at the waves, and when you can distinguish the waves as separate items rather than a flat sea, you unlock the parachute harness by turning a disc on the front. Turn it 90 degrees in an anti-clockwise direction, and then as you come down and as your feet touch the water, you hit the disc with the palm of your hand very smartly, and the parachute falls off, the harness falls off. That means you fall out of the harness into the water as your feet touch the water. And the advantage of that is that if there is very little wind, the parachute doesn't land on top of you, and you're swimming away with your legs getting tangled up in the chute cords, and that can really be quite dangerous. So what they want you to do is to allow the parachute just to drift away from your immediate position so that you're swimming free. So then you can inflate the Mae West and get into the dinghy, which is attached by a lanyard. It comes away from the parachute harness with this lanyard. So you inflate the dinghy, climb into the dinghy, and then wave to the recovery aircraft.
That sounds like the theory. Did they instruct you on the method of how to leave the aircraft if you had to bail out?
Not really. You probably heard them say that the Spitfire pilots used to prefer to turn it upside down and fall out. But the trouble is that when you're abandoning an aircraft, more often than not, you're abandoning it because you're not in charge. So you just got to get out the best way you can. But it's usually a matter of jettisoning the hood first. Get rid of the hood, and then you're not going to get tangled up with that as you leave. And then once you have got clear of the aircraft, however best you can, wait for a couple of seconds before you pull the parachute. Otherwise, the main parachute or the lead parachute might get tangled up with the tailplane. So you just want to be clear of the aircraft. And then coming down to earth was just, as I say, like a 16-foot jump down onto the ground, roll over, take off the parachute and run round it and hold it up. But it was very elementary training at that stage. It really was. Then we would do, later on in the course, night flying. And this was a matter of getting a very thorough brief on the lighting on the airfield, what that was going to be like, and what the lighting would be like when you were flying and you were looking for the airfield, what sort of flashing lights you might see. So they would take you out and sit with an instructor. You would sit in the aircraft and you'd sit on the hard standing for a while, getting used to the lighting in the cockpit. because there was no point in having the lighting in the cockpit turned up so bright that when you looked out you couldn't see anything. Because it's amazing how long it takes for your eyes to become dark adapted. And it is better if you can fly the aircraft without lights on in the cockpit, depending only on the fluorescence of the instruments. It wasn't always possible. Some of the instruments were awkwardly placed and the lighting was awkwardly placed compared with it, and you didn't get good fluorescence. So perhaps you had to have the lighting at a low level of brilliance, and you just wanted to get used to that, and then looking in the instruments and then looking outside to see what you wanted to see. Because obviously if you were night flying, you were night flying for a purpose. You had to look out and see what the purpose was. Anyway, once you'd sort of got used to the lighting in the cockpit, the instructor would taxi out with you, showing you what the lighting was like on the taxiway with blue lights and whatever other colours you had going round. And then when you came round to the entrance to the runway, you'd stop there and have a look at the runway and see what the runway lights were like and what the approach lights were like, and make sure nobody was coming in over the approach lights. And then ask if you'd go onto the runway and take off. Now, we, as I say, we always had this very primitive radio called the TR-9D. God, it was terrible. It used to fade ever so quickly. But anyway, you could at least keep in touch with the control tower while you were on the ground close to it. And they would give you a takeoff clearance and off you go. And of course, you're going down the runway with white lights either side, and when you got airborne and undercarriage up, these lights disappeared. So you had to be prepared to go immediately onto the instrument panel. And you knew when you went onto the instrument panel, you wanted to have the wee aircraft just above the horizontal line. You wanted to have the turn and bank indicator absolutely vertical. You wanted to have the direction indicator on the heading of the runway. And, you know, it was just all absolutely calm. And once you got up to perhaps 300 or 400 or 500 feet, then you would start to turn and just go off as if you were instrument flying. Excuse me, I had a bit of a cold last week. It was really, once you got used to it, very pleasant. So at night flying around was, you would fly around the circuit a couple of times, looking down at the airfield, getting used to what you were seeing. And then you would fly away from the airfield, and you could see the lights of Kingston over there and the lights of another small town, and gradually get used to what you could see when you were flying at night. And you'd thoroughly enjoy it, and then come back to land, and of course, exactly the same procedures as you'd learned during the day. Brakes, undercarriage, mixture pitch, flaps, and come into land, and there would be the duty pilot on the end of the runway ready to fire off a red if your undercarriage wasn't down. And he knew the undercarriage was down because the landing light didn't come on until they were. So he could see the landing light, therefore the wheels were down. So he wouldn't fire off a red. At least he wouldn't fire off a red unless there was somebody else making an approach at the same time. And if two of you were coming on the approach at the same time, you'd fire a red, and you'd both have to fly straight ahead and climb up to circuit height and start the whole ball rolling again. And by the time you'd climb back to circuit height, you knew why you'd been given the red. There was another aircraft close to you somewhere. Didn't happen often, but it did happen sometimes. Then we went from the main airfield at Kingston out to a small satellite airfield called Gananoque. And we lived under canvas there. And it was lovely because it was in the middle of the summer. And we were right on the edge of Lake Ontario. So when we weren't flying, we weren't actually doing ground instruction out there. So we used to go and swim. And it really was absolutely delightful. It was like a week or 10 days night flying. Just like a holiday, because we would sleep for, I don't know, a few hours in the morning, spend the afternoon swimming, and then go and prepare for night flying.
When you were night flying, could you actually see anything on the ground, really?
Oh, a lot would depend on the sort of moon situation, for example. On a moonlit night, it's surprising how much you can see. And particularly if you're looking into moon, you can see water reflected, lakes and rivers and that sort of thing. And of course, at Kingston and Gananoque, the lake edge, that would stand out very clearly because you were on the north shore of Lake Ontario and the moon would be to the south. And you just had a clear line and you could tell exactly where you were.
Would you use that as part of your orientation?
Oh, yes, really? Absolutely. Yes, you would always do that. Where you could get that sort of confirmation of where you were, you would use it all the time. So night flying was fine. We didn't actually do any night formation there. Not that I think it ever served any purpose, but we didn't do any of that.
What were flying conditions like generally in Canada?
Oh, delightful. It really was the most wonderful summer. Summer of 43, as far as I know. We were there for all the summer months. And the weather was absolutely delightful. We had very, very little rain, no storms of any kind. And we knew that if we had a flying program, we would complete it, simply because the weather was so good. I suppose that's why they chose Kingston as one of the training stations for us, because they knew we'd get through the training program quickly. Very good.
And you mentioned that sometimes you'd be flying two or three times a day.
Oh, yes.
How tiring was that?
Well, we were all young, energetic, physically fit. It wasn't tiring, not at all. You'd be mentally not tired, but satisfied, shall we say. You weren't exhausted physically or mentally, but it wasn't as bad as later on in operations. You could be flying four times a day.
And with the course here, the advanced course, were there any of your fellow cadets who would fall out at that stage?
Yes, there were always people failing the course, or dipping, as we used to call it. Some particular exercise that they weren't coping with, and they'd be given extra time on that exercise and extra tests. But sometimes some people just couldn't cope with that aspect, and then they would be sent back home to do something else. They might go and learn to be observers, or to join another branch of the Navy, or even perhaps transfer to the RAF.
Would that process, how would that occur? Would that occur quickly, or would they hang
around? Yes. Once the decision was made, they were away next day. Because I suppose the instructors felt it wasn't good to have somebody moping around with us in case it might affect our attitude towards what we were doing. But I think we were all young enough and brash enough not to let it worry us. Well, we were sorry when we lost one of our chums, but it was a matter of, sorry, old boy, hope you enjoy what you go to do and then get on with what we were going to do. But advanced line training, as far as I was concerned, was an absolutely delightful part of my flying career. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Your instructors there, were they Canadian or were they RAF?
Mainly RAF. There were one or two Canadians, but mainly RAF. I had a Flying Officer Jones, and he was quite an athletic type. So when we were off duty, off flying, and doing physical training or whatever, he would quite often come down with us, and he was quite good at the javelin, for example, and he would teach some of us how to throw the javelin, and then he was also a very fast runner, so he used to take us on in races and organise sports events of all kinds. That was the sort of thing that the instructors would do, and it meant that we became friendly with them as people, as well as being respecting them as instructors. And it seemed to work out quite well, as far as I was concerned. I never heard of any of the instructors causing any hiccups with the students at all.
While you were there any accidents at all that you witnessed?
Do you know, I don't remember any. I don't even remember any forced landings. All I can say is it's a very good indication of the standard of instruction we were being given. No, I don't remember any incidents of any kind.
So as the advanced training came to an end, how confident did you feel in your pilot's abilities?
Very keen to get on to the operational aircraft. Well, for example, towards the end of the course, four of us were sent off together to do formation flying. And the formation leader was a Lieutenant RN, and we were all leading airmen. So anyway, he took us off, and when he got away from the airfield, he started us all having a dogfight. We were all that overconfident. And when we got back, we found out that he had done this. He was chastised for leading us astray.
What would the mock dogfight?
Oh, it's just aerobatics, good fun, chasing one another around the sky. As I used to call it later on in life, it was chasing me Charlie. It was just trying to keep up with me. And it was good fun, but thinking back on it, I suppose with four of us milling around, it would have been too easy to have a mid-air collision, but we didn't.
And at this stage, had you been allocated to a particular role as a pilot?
No. Well, we didn't know. I don't think we had. I think the reports went from Kingston back to Leon Solent, and then they chose the numbers from the course that they needed for the various types of aircraft. And they would look at the flying reports to decide whether we were going to be fighter pilots or barracuda pilots or swordfish pilots or second line pilots. When I say second line, I mean not in an operational squadron. And that might mean going to an observer training school to fly the observers around, or to an air gunner training school to fly the air gunners about, or perhaps to a fleet requirements unit, and they would tow a target up and down and let the fleet fire at it. That's the sort of job that the second line pilots used to do. I don't know how they were chosen for the various roles, and I don't know how they were chosen for those who were promoted to commissioned rank and those who were left as ratings. But to be honest, it didn't seem to me to be a very fair system. When we got there, we got back to Leon Solent. Actually, we came back in the Aquitania from Halifax, Nova Scotia, by train down to London and then down to Leon Solent. And we were lined up outside the divisional officer's office, standing in three rows. And he leant out of the window with a list in his hand, and he read out a list of names. And he said, "Those that I've just read out, their names are commissioned, fall in over there. Those whose names I haven't yet read are non-commissioned, wait over there." That's how we got our commissions, read from a list. And when I looked at the ones who were non-commissioned, I thought, this is grossly unfair, I don't understand it. There was three of my particular chums remained rating pilots, but I was commissioned. And I don't understand it, because it seemed to me that the rating pilots mainly were those with very strong regional accents. And I think that is pathetic. But I had a strong regional accent. I had quite a broad Scots accent at the time. So I don't know how it was done. But the other thing which I thought was grossly unfair was that two of them in particular had got substantially better ground instruction marks than I had. And as far as I knew, their assessment as a pilot was average or above average, much the same as mine. and I couldn't understand why I had been selected for that job and they were put there. Unless it was just an arbitrary picking your name out of a hat, merely. But it was grossly unfair.
And had you a preference at that point for what type of pilot you would like to be?
Well, I thought I'd like to be a fighter pilot, one of these dashing young Battle of Britain types. But in fact, I was sent on to Barracudas.
Was that the case amongst your peers at that time? Would they have been all interested in fighter pilots, or did they just want to be pilots?
I don't think there was a lot of very strong preference. It was just a niggling feeling, I might like to do that. But I do know pilots who became fighter pilots who would have liked to have gone on to the TBRs, as they were called, Torpedo Bomber Reconnaissance. And that aircraft was the Swordfish originally, then the Albacore, and then the Barracuda. Now, I went up to an RAF station at Errol in Scotland. It was on the south bank of the Tay between Perth and Dundee. And the idea there was that we would get back into using British-type aircraft instruments and flying in Britain with British weather and British air traffic control, and the fact that there were no lights anywhere in the country. And we had a fortnight at Earl just getting used to flying in British conditions. And we were flying Magister 1 and Magister 2 type aircraft. The Magister 1 was an inline engine, the Magister 2 was a radial engine. And I think it was just to give us experience of the two different types of engine. And they were the British equivalent of the Harvard, mainly. And they had exactly the same sort of thing with variable pitch, retractable undercarriage, flaps and all that sort of stuff. So we flew those around, and while we were there, there were two other aircraft that we would have the opportunity to fly. One was a Hurricane and one was a Gloucester Gladiator. And I was desperate to fly these two aircraft, so I volunteered immediately. And I did, in fact, get a chance to fly the Hurricane, which was great. I thoroughly enjoyed that. And then I came back and wanted to fly the Gloucester Gladiator, which, of course, as you know, is a biplane. And damn me if it wasn't unserviceable. It didn't become serviceable till after I left the station.
What was that Hurricane like to fly you?
It was absolutely amazing. Of course, such a powerful engine compared with what we were used to. Much more powerful than the Masters we were flying. And the aircraft was much lighter to control. And you had to really be quite careful that you didn't overcompensate and just almost fly it with fingertips rather than with a strong grip on the control column. But it was just a matter of flying around, and the fact you could get so high so quickly. And over that part of Scotland, which is central Scotland, if you get high enough, you can see almost the whole of Scotland. On a good day, you can certainly see the east and west coasts at the same time, and you can see as far north as Lossiemouth, and you can see as far down as the Solway Firth. And you notice I pick water, because that's what stands out clearest when you're looking from altitude. And I loved that. I thought it was great. And I flew it and was comfortable flying it, and I was comfortable landing it and taxiing it. So it was a real joy to fly.
Did you receive any instruction on it, or did you just read pilot notes?
Well, pilot's notes, and then one of the instructors would take you out and show you the cockpit and just make sure you knew where everything was. Quite often the instructors would ask you to do a blindfold check. They would blindfold you one way or another and say, right, put your hand on so-and-so. And you just sort of learn to get round the cockpit by touch. And it just made you more aware, because you'd go out and learn it. Yes, you were always instructed on the layout of the cockpit before you were sent off solo.
And this period, were you, you know, when you were flying around, were you left to your own devices, or were you kind of briefed on what things you should be doing?
were very much left to our own devices. So we would go off and practice whatever. We never had flew with an instructor. The instructors were there, but there were very few instructors compared with the number of students. And they just made sure that we knew the aircraft we were flying and help us if we had any queries.
So it was really familiarisation again, and as you said, with the weather, to get back to the British climate, really.
Yeah, and as I say, with British aircraft instruments, which were slightly different from the American ones. And it was a good idea, I think. And then from there, I was sent to Crail.